Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority.
We are joined today by Amelia Womack, who is a British politician and deputy leader of the Green Party of England and Wales. Following a BSc in Environmental Biology, Amelia completed an MSc in Environmental Technology at Imperial College London in 2013 with a thesis entitled Who's Afraid of Environmental Law? How the Law of Ecocide Can Secure Our Environment for Business Resilience. She's been an active campaigner on this issue since then, and this will be the theme of our discussion today. Hello, Amelia. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, thank you for the invite. It's good to be here.
Okay, well, could you begin, Amelia, by telling us a little bit about your background and what prompted you to give priority to this topic for your thesis?
So, as you can tell from what I've studied in the past, that the environment has been a real key factor of my beliefs. Everything we do is built on the environment, whether that's if you believe in social justice, then actually for social justice, you need a secure environment for people to live on, for food, for water, for shelter. And from as a result of people turning the environment into goods and services, we therefore have business and the economy as we know it. So the environment is the very foundations to everything we do. And this is what's really inspired me to get involved in environmental protection and making sure that we have that, save that for future generations.
Okay, so what is ecocide?
So ecocide is an environmental law, and the whole idea comes from the fact that to be able to address an issue, it's easier if you've got a name for that issue. We actually, in many ways, this has come from the role of being able to define genocide. And when in Germany, when those horrendous actions were taking place, people weren't really sure what was happening because almost people weren't able to comprehend it, because without a definition and without a word to define it, then people weren't able to call it out. And that's where the idea of ecocide come from. It comes from a combination of Greek and Latin that describes a word that's almost like genocide for the environment. And the environmental destruction that we see is from everything, from the tar sands in Canada, from fracking in the UK, from the oil drilling in the Arctic. This is a destruction, the long-term destruction of the environment, which coincidentally is actually illegal during times of war, but during times of peace, we're apparently allowed to get away with it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I find the term very powerful. For me, for example, I find global warming acknowledges much more what's occurring to the planet than the more neutral climate change. Similarly, the word ecocide seems to explicitly hold people or organisations responsible as opposed to, say, the more generally used biodiversity lot, which, like climate change, could just as well mean an independently occurring process. Am I just nitpicking here, or is choosing the appropriate way to describe these issues important?
I think it is important, and I think that you're right, it is a powerful word. And actually, it's something that they wanted to have embedded into the Human Rights Convention, because the environment should be a human right. And I even think going from that angle puts a whole new importance as having the environment as a necessity rather than a nice to have. And especially with the complexity of words and language, that things like biodiversity would be more appealing to someone with a science background or somebody who understands the issue than somebody who's just who's not necessarily in touch with all of the terminology. Whereas, as I said, ecocide, it's got so much connotation and so much power behind it. I think it's really important to have that right definition.
Yeah, and there's two types of ecocide, if I'm right, isn't there? There's the human-generated ecocide, but there's also natural ecocide. How do they differ?
Yeah, well, natural ecocide is if there was a volcano that went off and destroyed the landscape around it. Obviously, that is a long-term destruction of the environment that will change that environment for a while. But that differs from human-impacted ecocide, which isn't part of the natural process of this world. It's something that we're enforcing on the environment and causing these environmental changes that, as I said, can last for decades, but aren't part of nature as a whole.
Yeah, okay. But then how is it decided what is ecocide? For example, with, say, nuclear power or genetically modified crops, there's still considerable debate even among environmental groups on whether, on the balance of things, they are beneficial or not.
I think that with ecocide, it's not about being beneficial, it's about the long-term destruction. And it's very clear that if it's man-made, then it's man-made ecocide. So from nuclear, although there are obviously debates around the benefits of nuclear, if there was an explosion of a nuclear reactor, what happened in Fukushima, that is obviously ecocide. That's man-made ecocide rather than natural ecocide. And I think that that's actually one of the important things about the law, is it breaks away from the debate in terms of what's better for the environment. It puts things in the form of a debate of protecting the environment at its core as a central value to that.
Okay. And how is the law geared at the moment? What's the problem with the law at the moment?
I think one of the problems with the law at the moment is that it's almost around risk diversion and who is causing the cost. So if you look at pollution, for example, and the polluter pays principle, that isn't saying that we shouldn't pollute. It's not saying that pollution causes this long-term damage. It's saying that once you've polluted, the polluter pays. And that this almost creates a private profit, public risk, without actually taking into account environmental rights as a whole into it, the core of it. And this is basically, instead of looking at the outcome of environmental destruction, trying to make sure that that destruction doesn't happen in the first place. And I think that the Arctic is a very good example of that, a pristine environment, an environment where very few people have actually been, and going and drilling for oil would disrupt that forever. Once that's happened, even with the basic law and polluter pays and all of those aspects, we will never get that environment back. That's gone for future generations. Yeah. And it's something that current laws don't necessarily take into account.
Yeah. So is the emphasis on current law that the interests of the shareholders are put first then?
I think that maintaining the status quo in many ways is put at hand. And I think we did have a brief discussion at the start of this about the role of the slave trade and changes in slavery, when one of the problems with ecocide and environmental law is that you have a lot of businesses saying that it will be uncompetitive, and that by changing the law, that will mean that they can't compete with other companies, it will impact their business. And the atrocities that happened with the slave trade obviously a very different issue, but the same arguments are now being used for the environmental law, that changes in environmental law makes business uncompetitive. One of the interesting things that I think we see with business at the moment is many of them think that this will put them on a level playing field. So many different companies trying to do the right thing for the environment, and they're unable to remain competitive, whereas if everybody was on a level playing field, everyone had to act the same laws, then that would be better for them. So it's kind of, and one of the things about the slave trade is that once slavery was abolished, not a single business went out of business, because we put in the infrastructure, we put in the support to make sure that businesses were able to keep going without exploiting people and putting them through that horrendous situation.
That's interesting. But there was also, if I remember correctly, the businesses were compensated in today's terms in billions, weren't they, for the loss of the income they were going to get through slavery. I imagine that's something that would be quite difficult to do with this situation, though.
I think compensation isn't the best route in terms of environmental protection, but what we do need is a pause button. And as I said, that kind of level playing field. If what we saw with the CFCs being banned was by making all companies, it's been done on a different level. So in the in America and in Europe, we've got different rules than in Africa as a result of changing development. But what we saw in terms of but banning CFCs was it was actually a company who wanted to do it, who was trying to push that as a change in law, who managed to galvanize different countries, different companies, and as a result of cross deals between Europe and deals between America, we managed to do that so that businesses remained on this level playing field, and no longer were they competing as a result of creating the cheapest product using CFCs. They were then competing on making the best products without CFCs.
Okay, and then in regard to this, what role do you think the TTIP initiative is going to play? Is that going to be a potential danger in that regard?
I think that any trade deal can be dangerous to the environment. I always think it's a really interesting example while talking about TTIP to talk about the Danish bottle case. Now, that's as a result of trade deals that we already have, and the beverage industry actually sued Denmark because they said that reusable bottles, the bottle return system, was uncompetitive because you had to make bottles that was, the glass was stronger, that was of a specific design so they could be refilled. And they deemed this uncompetitive because they weren't able to put their marketing into their glass bottles. So you weren't able to have those curves or things that linked their logos. So we see trade deals impacting our environmental laws and our environmental culture sometimes in ways that maybe we don't expect. So I feel like it's not just TTIP that can impact on this. Other international trade deals also impact on our environmental laws. And this is why with the campaign for the European debate is that actually by having a cross-European policy means that you're not competing on individual countries. And one of the key things the campaign is pushing for is really having that global understanding. And if we can get global support and global people signing up from all around the world based on this idea, then that will mean that its competition won't be at the heart of that decision-making.
We touched on the slave trade and maybe comparisons there with history. Well, two things about the slave trade. First of all, it was a decades-long struggle, and also it needed the public behind it. It was one thing, you know, for Wilberforce to be the, you know, the main player and lots of other people in politics, but it basically got passed through because it had the will of the people behind it. To what extent are we at that stage with this law?
I actually find it really interesting, the journey that has happened with this. Now, I got involved with, I was inspired by Polly Higgins, who is a lawyer and wanted to fight for environmental rights. And I saw Polly speak, it must have been around 2012, and she really inspired me about this opportunity. And when I started to look into the work she was doing, I felt like I went out and I started to ask politicians questions about it, getting people to sign the petition for it, trying to engage more people. And I'd normally start the discussion by describing what Ecocide was. And here we are just a few years later, and actually a lot of people I speak to do know what Ecocide is. Many of them are politicians. Many of them are in a campaigning roles in terms of social or environmental justice. But I think that's the first step. Yeah. Is it this word becoming common language, becoming a common understanding? And I think it has the potential to win over the hearts and minds of people, because you can just look out and look at something and say, well, that's ecocide. And instead of saying, with fracking, for example, well, you know, that's it's got the potential of poisoning groundwater. It's got the potential of causing minor earthquakes. It's got the potential of doing this. You can say it's got the potential to cause ecocide. And that understanding, I think, is what the simplicity of it is what wins those hearts and minds. And I feel that public support's growing and public understanding's growing. And the more that there are small wins, like the Shell pulling out of the Arctic, and public pressure put on a lot of these campaigns where millions of people are signing petitions to stop that happening, I think it's things like ecocide that will make the complexities of other debates more simple. Yeah. And hopefully mean that although it's going to take a few years for that word to be in people's minds, that once it is, hopefully it will help win that public opinion as well.
Okay, but I suppose one concern though is that the difference between the struggle for, say, slavery an ecocide is that we don't appear to have decades to play with. How can we get around this?
That's true. I mean, in many ways, I find it hard to compare the struggles other than the arguments that are being used, because obviously in terms of our history, it's a very horrendous part to be comparing to what's happening in the present day. And so I think that just in terms of language is the best way to compare that. But as you said as well, in terms of timescales, we don't necessarily have decades. And I think we do have environmental laws that are changing, etching away at what is ecocide, and environmental laws that are picking up on a lot of the damage that is happening around the world. And there's a number of different ways this can happen. There's the public opinion that you mentioned, or there's the businesses such as the CFC example. That we mentioned. It was DuPont who was the business there that tried to push those changes. Now, you also have the aspect where policy can drive it. I was going to say, with business, actually, it's almost when you talk to businesses who have strong internal environmental laws, it's almost like they've got their internal law of ecocide. And there was a brilliant book called Zero Noughts. And the idea of zero noughts is that we have so many institutionalized problems that if you're going to have environmental or sustainability policy, then lots of companies will just go for the low-hanging fruits, rather than if you challenge them to reduce their carbon emissions by 40%, they'll tend to meet maybe 23%, maybe 30%, but they won't quite get the 40% because you're just reaching the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Whereas if you challenge them to zero, then they'll change all of the institutions, change all of their systems, and some of them don't make zero, but actually they're so close to zero because they've thought of entirely different ways of doing things, that that smaller push at the end is so much more significant than the challenging them to reduce them by 40%. And I think that internal law of ecocide shows what we can do. And although it's obviously environment and sustainability policy that they have internally, it is a kind of law of ecocide. But then you also have the government aspect. So if governments adapt environmental law and governments want to take this on to protect their environments or to protect people, then that can also have a key influence. And we've been seeing this in a number of different countries. So the first country to adopt a law of ecocide was Bolivia. And Bolivia will stop any long-term destruction of the environment by man. I believe Andorra has also signed up. And a number of different countries are starting to see the benefits of this law and ensuring that we tackle this long-term destruction of the environment. And I think just like the example within businesses, it's only by really challenging the structures and challenging the way that we're doing things that we can address those issues. Because if we just tinker around the edges, we're not going to achieve that wish to protect the environment for future generations.
Well, that makes sense, Amelia. This might be an obvious question, but what's the Green Party's position on ecocide?
We support a law of ecocide. I think it was about 3 years ago at conference. So with Green Party policy, members bring evidence-based policy that's discussed, debated and voted on by our membership. And we had the discussion at that conference. And because the environment is one of our basic founding principles, then obviously the Green Party is a strong advocate for the role of ecocide. And I believe that our MEPs, Molly, Keith and Jean, are working in terms of securing environmental rights within the European Parliament as well.
OK. Is it important with an issue like this also, from a psychological perspective, to strike a balance between sort of catastrophizing on the one hand and a bright siding on the other?
One of the things about this law specifically is the way that we talk about it is that it's not necessarily catastrophizing or bright siding. It's basically saying, this is where we are. This is what's happening. Let's stop continuing to mess things up. So yeah. It's that idea of pressing a pause button and trying to right the wrongs rather than saying, well, if you do this, it's going to be disastrous. Or if you do this, there's going to be a bright side. And I think the catastrophe, I used to read the Independent every day during, I think, 2007. I found quite an interesting year for the environment because it was actually the 1 year where public opinion believed that environmental destruction was something to be more concerned about than terrorism. And it's the only point, one of the very few points in our history that that's actually happened. And the Independent used to run every day. Basically, it kind of felt like the end of the world was nigh. And even as someone who's a staunch environmentalist, by the end of it, it was kind of a bit much. It's pushing people who are, you're preaching to the choir. It was just too much information, and just I think it tires people out and it wears people out. And people do need a story of hope. And I think that the idea. Eleanor Ahlstrom, who is an economist, she actually, although she didn't study economics, she's won a Nobel Prize in economy. She always says, I've mentioned Future Generations a couple of times, but she always says that every decision we should make, we should think about 7 generations time and what impact it will have on them. And I think that this is like this message of hope comes into that, that it's not, this is not just the world for us now, it's the world that we're leaving for these future generations. And I think that those messages of hope come through a lot stronger, and that people's connectedness to the environment or to other people or to future generations might seem a little bit fluffy around the edges, but actually I think people do understand those principles and have those connections. And we can look on the bright side in terms of the changes of policy, and we can look at the disasters. But at the end of the day, if there's not a message of hope and opportunity from that, then I think you're not going to win people's hearts and minds.
Just to sort of summarise what you're saying, you seem to be saying that we need everyone on board. It's very important not to demonise the business community as well. You need everyone here playing their part, really, don't you?
And I think, and this is a fairly small fry example of this, but what we've been seeing with the plastic bags, for example, the 5p charge on plastic bags. So some businesses were doing it first, some people were doing it first, and then it became law in, I think it was Wales first, it's become law in Scotland, and the countries have gradually changed. It's law in Northern Ireland, and now it's law in England. And obviously at the beginning, we've got a small amount of chaos. There have obviously been some funny examples of people's reactions to it. I think most people just realise that under their sink they'd have a small stash of savings, of carrier bags they can go out and use. But I think that this is actually a small-scale example of the change, how public opinion, how business and how lawmakers all interact to do something. And you're never going to get everybody on board, that there will be a reaction from it. But I mean, that change has been fundamental to protect our waterways, to protect our environment, to make sure that we're not producing excessive amounts of plastic. And at the end of the day, is a far better policy than giving out free plastic bags. So although it's a small example, I think it shows the role of those three groups and how those three groups, in terms of their changing attitudes, can work together to achieve something.
Great. OK. The middle way, Amelia, as we understand it in the societies, is this idea that by avoiding sort of fixed, rigid views about things, whether they're cognitive biases or, you know, dogmatic assumptions about things, we can arguably make better decisions. What is your understanding of it, if any, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think that nobody can know everything, so it's really important that we're always open to discussion, debate and new ideas. And I think the idea that one of the things that I really like about the Green Party is that there's never this notion that one policy fits all, and that it means that we can discuss and debate the additional ideas and additional thoughts around something. And I think that that is really important when it comes to the law of ecocide as well. The law itself isn't the one way of changing things. And I see that some people think it might be taxation. Some people think it's penalties. Some people think it's even just getting business to understand the principles of risk management and how that works to environment and sustainability. So I think it's a really interesting idea. And I think it really does apply to the law of ecocide, also to the Green Party.
OK. And my last question, Amelia, if people wanted to find out more about your work personally and particularly ecocide and environmental law, how would they go about it?
Well, I think to begin with, I do enjoy watching a TED Talk. It's I probably watch far too many TED Talks, if that's possible. But definitely check out Polly Higgins's TED Talk on the law of ecocide. I think that she explains things really clearly, really concisely, and in a way that really inspires people as to what we can achieve through changes in policy and law. So definitely have a look at that. And in terms of my work, then you can follow me on Twitter, which is @Amelia_Womack, or on Facebook, which is Green Amelia Womack. And although there's lots of campaigns in terms of social and environmental justice, as well as election campaigns, then there'll definitely be elements of ecocide popping up.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Amelia. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It's been really a really interesting discussion, and yeah, a fantastic society as well.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.